This is SiriusXM Doctor Radio.
From the heart of the NYU Langone Medical Center, here is psychiatrist Dr. Dolores Malaspina.
Hi out there. Welcome to the show. This is the Psychiatry Show on NYU Doctor Radio. We're on SiriusXM 81. All NYU doctors all the time make this a center point of your dial, so to speak. Today we have two great segments to our show. First, we're going to talk about severe mental illness in the family, how one courageous person understood and dealt with that and helped her sister recover. And then in our second hour, we will talk about a new book called Fortitude. Are you a woman, 35? Thinking about aging, or 45, 55, a woman 65 or 75 thinking about aging? What does it mean to age for women? Our guest in the next segment, Sarah Brokaw, an hour from now, will talk about her new book, Fortitude. But first, in this segment, let's talk about severe mental illness. Many families have a member with severe and persistent mental illness. Doctors spend a lot of time separating severe mental disorders into categories, but the categories haven't told us much. Do you have a relative with severe PTSD? That's post-traumatic stress disorder, or depression, or manic depression, bipolar disease, or schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, or severe personality disorder. These are the mental illnesses that really interfere with someone's functioning. And interfere with their ability to generate a happy life. Sadly, another part of many of these diseases is a lack of awareness by the person who's ill that anything is wrong with them. So as a family member, you may be trying to help someone who doesn't want to be helped. And on top of all of that, we have stigma. Now, the disease we call schizophrenia affects 3 million American adults. That is a large number of people. Schizophrenia is a brain disease, like all of them that I mentioned, that can get somewhat better with treatment. And treatment can actually make a tremendous difference in letting someone have some quality of life. So even if we can't cure these diseases, treatment makes a big difference. Well, in this section, we are going to talk to Margaret Hawkins. She has a sister, Barb, who for decades, after she developed schizophrenia early in her marriage, returned to her parents' home and lived there cloistered with a supervision of her parents, but never had help. She was a prisoner of her fear, hearing voices, paralyzed with fear, really. And was never evaluated or treated. And after the parents died, Margaret was able to step up, and she's going to tell us how she got Barb back, the title of her book, or the subtitle of her book. And I'm delighted to have her back on the show with us because she was here when her book first came out in hardcover. And now, Margaret, your book going by the main title now of After Schizophrenia is out in soft cover, too. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you, Dolores. It's great to be back.
Oh, so nice to have you on the show. I wonder, because many people listening now won't have listened before, or if they have, they could hear it again and learn even more from you, Margaret. Would you tell us your story and your sister's story? How did it begin?
Well, it began with my sister's very promising early life. Now, she's 11 years older than I am, so I didn't know her when she was a child. But by the time I was old enough to really, you know, have experiences with her and memories that I remember now, I was, you know, 5 or 6, and she was in high school and then going off to college. And she was a spectacular young woman, as I'm learning that many siblings of, you know, people who have schizophrenic siblings remember them this way too, as these kind of stellar people. I mean, it's not always the case, but that was certainly the case of Barb. You know, and she was just, I mean, she really had it together, and you can see from the photographs in the book that she was a beautiful young woman, and she was also very, very bright and ambitious and accomplished and in many ways, you know, socially as well as intellectually, and she was kind of athletic, and she was artistic, and so she went off to college, you know, with great promise, and then in college she began to falter a little bit. And as I say, I was a child, so I didn't, you know, I don't have an objective perspective on her then, but and she kind of got back on her feet and went back to school and married a young graduate student from Iraq, and they eventually went over there to live, and all looked pretty good for her, and she wanted to be a writer, and she was getting stuff published. And then when they came back, it was this shocking, fracturing moment in my family's life, because he brought her back for a summer. Something was wrong, and we just didn't realize what was wrong, and she was just gone. She was, you know, she was a completely different person. She looked different. She sounded different. She didn't recognize us. She was speaking in accents. She was laughing hysterically and crouching on the floor and muttering to herself. Mm-hmm. And, of course, now we know that was schizophrenia.
Right, so you described that she was responding to stimuli that you couldn't see or hear, the laughing, that she was behaving bizarrely, that she was disconnected from the family. So they could not have even been in denial, Margaret. It was so clear at that point that your sister was mentally ill.
You would think so, and it was clear that she was mentally ill. But because my parents were so afraid of mental illness, and for good reason, and for the, you know, for the aftermath, because they'd had experiences with it in their families. And so I think as obvious as it seems to us now from the description, and as likely as it was because of the family history, it was so horrible that they needed to understand it differently. I mean, that's kind of how I see it now. A tragic kind of denial.
Right. So I hope this conversation helps people who may have seen a change in a loved one that's very consistent, or feel that they have to so walk on eggshells to keep a loved one or friend or colleague from overreacting, that they have like started modifying their own behavior because people haven't dealt frankly with the fact that someone is becoming mentally ill.
That's exactly what my family did, walking on eggshells. And, you know, when you put it that way, I'd never heard it expressed quite that way. That's kind of a description of how my family dealt with, you know, other members too. And so it was just kind of one more step into the extreme zone of accommodating unaccommodatable behavior to accept my sister's, you know, really delusions and hallucinations as the new normal, and that's what they did. Also, there was this added element of strangeness in the fact that she had come back from the Middle East. Now, her husband brought her back. He was rocking. He was certainly not behaving that way, and he was terribly worried. But somehow it was easier for them, I think, to think that, well, you know, these weird things she was saying were somehow reports on real experiences she'd had, which, of course, wasn't the case.
So those reports that someone gives who's had a break from reality, they believe them with their full heart, and it seems as if they've experienced them.
Right.
But the science of psychiatry shows that they're delusions, that sometimes thoughts people have are indistinguishable from experiences they've had, and they can report experiences that never occurred, and that's the delusions. Now, did she also hallucinate and hear voices, do you think, from the beginning, Margaret?
I am absolutely sure that she did, because her reports often began with the words, "Now they're telling me." And this went on for years and years. And occasionally, you know, I mean, she's so much better, but so sometimes I hear her say that even now. And So she had this attentive look of, you know, she was always very smart and always had this, you know, hyper awareness about her. And so she would get that look that she, you know, used to have when she was talking about books or ideas or something. But she would get that look and then say, now they're telling me, and then say these weird things. So, it has all the appearances of her hearing voices and then either responding to them directly or telling a third party, not exactly me, but maybe some other hallucinated third party, about what they are saying to her.
Right. Now, at a time like that, what the science shows us is that the parts of the brain that generate activities, as we all need to do, and the part that receives stimuli from the world, the connections have just broken down. Mm. And so someone is really in a reality that's not the same one that they're living in. They're in a reality generated by their thoughts, which are fragmented.
Yeah.
But it is so common to do what your parents did, for family members to choose to tiptoe around it and not take the steps to get their loved one's help. I can't imagine if a loved one had, a disease of chest pain or diabetes or an asthma attack, and they were dying of that a loving family would not insist on treatment. But for psychiatric diseases, we have all sorts of roadblocks.
It's absolutely true. And you mentioned stigma in your introduction, and stigma is the terrible, terrible enemy. And it was worse then. This was the 1970s when my sister, first had her, obvious psychotic break. And, then the belief was still prevalent that parents were responsible, and particularly mothers were responsible for schizophrenia. And there was this phenomenon. Well, I'm telling you, of course, you know this.
No, you're telling our audience with me, Margaret.
Okay. Well, I'm saying what the doctor here knows, that there was this phenomenon called the schizophrenogenic mother. And this was a scientific term, a psychiatric term, that was used to describe a certain kind of cold, punitive mother whose behavior caused this disease. And this was just common knowledge.
Commonly believed. Yes, commonly exactly. Believed and totally untrue and unsubstantiated. But it still, I think you're right, forms a bit of a kernel for parents, where if they admit to themselves that their loved child has any psychiatric or mental disease, the self-blame and self-hatred keeps them from taking the steps. The vast majority of these diseases are not reflective of how someone was raised or the experiences they had, the exception being how PTSD, a traumatic experience, can color the mental illness. But for autism, for manic depression, for severe depression, for a lot of the personality disorders, parents should not feel blamed, and they should not allow that self-loathing to interfere with the getting of treatment. So stigma. The other thing about stigma is it is the biggest enemy of getting mental health treatment, even for people who themselves realize they have a disease. They're embarrassed to talk about it. They feel that it's their fault.
Right.
But it's no more someone's fault than if they developed high blood pressure or diabetes or liver failure. Margaret, how can we get people not to stigmatize mental illness? I mean, you're doing it by talking about your sister who has schizophrenia. I have spoken publicly many times about my sister who has schizophrenia. Is that going to be enough? Is that all we can do?
I think it's a start. I mean, I think for people who are living in the world responsibly, who are, leaders in, various fields. I'm a teacher too, and I know you teach, and, people who are responsible for other people standing up and saying, this is in my family, and this person is a loved person and she's not dangerous. I think that helps. But I also think that there have to be social and governmental changes. I think there has to be more understanding somehow from the medical community and in the psychiatric and the community health, mental health community, past on to the government and the agencies that, and the insurance companies, so that mental illness is not seen as, you know, oh, it's just about behavior. It's about, or just about the personality. It's psychological. Mental illness is physical illness in many cases. It originates in the body. It originates in the brain. And so that help, you know, can be sought on a medical basis. And I think that will go a long way to alleviating stigma also.
Yeah.
Also, I think just encouraging people to speak up and ask for help. I mean, this sounds so elementary, but in my family, it didn't happen. And this is one of my big messages. It's such a plain thing to say, but we didn't do it. Nobody in my family felt free to ask for help. It was this terrible secret. And I think just, you know, kind of airing out this secret goes some distance to balancing out this stigma.
I think, you know, I want to do a show in the future just on secrets of all kinds. I think secrets in families really can damage the generations. So secrets of all kinds can be very, very difficult. But you're right, keeping the secret here.
Each one, you know, do them.